So I would like to start off with the principles and practice of vaccinology. And what I would like to do is actually talk about the immune response you get from different types of vaccines and to give you some rules of thumb with which you can actually tackle the problems you see in daily practice when you are vaccinating your traveler. And I will touch upon aging of the population and what you can expect actually when you vaccinate people. And the second part will be about the impairment of the immune system, and that will be after the lunch or the lunch break, the coffee break. We will then go into detail with the immunosuppressed traveler. So to start off, just this slide, it's a very busy slide showing you the history of vaccine development, starting already in 1798, and it's still going on at the moment. And actually, what through history, different types of vaccine strategies were used. First of all, Jenner took an animal virus to immunize humans to protect them against smallpox. So you use actually a virus that is not human to immunize people. Pasteur then started to attenuate viruses, so you get a live attenuated vaccine. That was very impractical in situations like in India. So the English actually started to inactivate whole cells, whole bacteria, and whole viruses because they had a huge area in India they wanted to immunize and that they could not use attenuated live strains. It was impossible. So then you get the whole cell inactivated vaccines. And then further on in history, people started to inactivate toxins or to chop up the bacteria into small pieces so you get subunit vaccines. Or you can take the polysaccharide capsule of some bacteria to immunize. And finally, going up to the end, people started to construct virus-like particles, like in the HPV vaccine, where you actually mimic a virus and just put on some of the antigens on the outside, but it doesn't contain nuclear acids for replication. So I want to take you during a travel of the vaccine into the body, and I will start off with a subunit vaccine, so a protein vaccine. So what happens if you inject a child with a vaccine? Well, first of all, it gives a trauma. Not only physical trauma, psychological trauma, but also physical trauma. You induce inflammation at the site of injection, and actually that attracts antigen-presenting cells. And antigen-presenting cells look a little bit like waiters. You know, they take up the order, which is a part of the vaccine, they break it down in small pieces, and they present it on a plate to the immune cells. And you can see here, this is the plate, which is called the major histocompatibility class molecule type 2, and it contains the antigen of the vaccine, and it just goes around and showing it to the T and B cells whether they like that type of drink or not. Now, more schematically, it looks like that. So here you have your antigen-presenting cell, and this is the, well, this was the bacterium, and this, but it could be a vaccine as well. It was chopped down in small pieces, 10 amino acids to be exact, and it is shown in a plate to a T-cell. Now, how does a T-cell know that this antigen is actually foreign and not from your own body? So it needs to get a second signal to tell the T-cell that it is not from your own body, because you do not want to raise an immune response against your own body cells. And therefore, many of the pathogens contain conserved patterns through evolution, and those patterns are recognized by the antigen-presenting cell as being foreign. So fungi, bacteria, viruses have all conserved molecular patterns which tell the antigen-presenting cell that these antigens are from a foreign origin. And this actually gives you the second signal which will activate the T cell to react. Now, if you if you take a vaccine and you inject a whole bacterium, then actually this contains all the elements to tell the antigen-presenting cell that this is a foreign substance. But if you're going to chop it down in small pieces, you need some extra help. And this is what we call the adjuvant. It's shown here, I think. No, it's not. Well, this is signal one. This is the first signal. This is signal two. And for the vaccine, you have the third one. It's the adjuvant, which is actually often put into the vaccine to help, especially when you have small pieces of antigen. Adjuvare means giving help, and this makes the immune response stronger. Now, the receptors to recognize those patterns from pathogens are everywhere in the cell. And this is, again, a schematic view of a cell. This is the cell membrane, and on the outside of the cell membrane, you have various types of receptors. They are called toll-like receptors, and they are able to recognize parts of bacteria. For example, LPS, the lipopolysaccharide, is recognized by TLR4. But also in the cell, inside the cell, you have receptors, like, for example, in the endosome, where you have receptors for nucleic acids, which come from viruses. So viruses use this area to build up their own viral structure, and therefore they are recognized in the right compartment in the cell. And finally, you also have in the cytosol, you have receptors for conserved patterns. And the aluminium salt we are using as the oldest adjuvant in a vaccine is actually acting on the receptor present in the cytosol. So the aluminium salt is taken up by the antigen-presenting cell, and it will result in a polymerization of a large complex, which will finally produce IL-1 beta, which is a pro-inflammatory response, and that will cause the help, that will give the help the antigen needs to raise an antibody response. And this is the oldest adjuvant we have, and many vaccines still contain aluminium salt as an adjuvant. There have been developments, and I think one of the future developments in vaccine development will be to make new adjuvants that can direct the immune response in a certain direction you want to go it to. For example, you can actually address the TLR receptor 4 with a structure derived from LPS. This is the monophosphorylipid. It's derived from Salmonella. It's been cleaned. It's been completely sterilized, and then it's used as an adjuvant, and it has a very strong effect on, for example, the response to Hep B vaccine. This is a study in hemodialysis patients receiving 40 milligrams of Hep B vaccine four times, so at day zero, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and 6 months. And in yellow, you can see the normal vaccination schedule. But if you combine the aluminium with the monophosphorylipids, you can see a much stronger response. First of all, the bars indicate the percentage of people who are protected after the injection, and you can see that with the extra stimulation of TLR4, more people are protected in a shorter time. And in addition, the line indicates the height of the antibody levels. And in hemodialysis patients who respond poorly to Hep B vaccine, this is clearly a very potential vaccine to give high antibody levels. Besides, the other side of the story, it's not only immunogenetic, but it is also reactogenetic. So you get more often a red and painful arm because it causes more inflammation, as you can expect, because it has to attract those antigen-presenting cells. Now, there's a second problem. The T and B cells are only around in the bloodstream for 30 minutes. So how is it possible that if you inject your vaccine in the arm and the antigen-presenting cell is picking up the antigen, then the chances of meeting the right T or B cell at the place of injection is actually very, very slim. So you need a meeting place, somewhere where the antigen-presenting cell is recognizing the T cell and around, and vice versa. So, and that meeting place for antigens which are present in the soft tissue is the lymph node. If you present the antigen in the bloodstream, it will be the spleen. So the lymph node is the place to meet for the antigens presented in the soft tissue. The antigens present in the blood are presented in the spleen. And it's a kind of countercurrent. So indeed, the antigen-presenting cells come one way and the TMB cells come the other way, so to optimize the chance of meeting each other. And this is shown here. You can see the antigen-presenting cell. This one is carrying the antigen of the vaccine. And then TMB cells come in and they just look at each other. They see whether they like each other. And, well, some of them don't and just go away again, whereas the others recognize the antigen and then they receive the appropriate co-stimulus and then they will start to replicate. Now, often immune response is actually described as warfare. So you have soldiers and killing, but actually I think it's quite romantic. So again, this is your waiter and this is the T cell which has recognized the antigen on the plate, and then the connection between those two cells becomes very intense. And there are all kinds of signals they gave to each other, which we call cytokines, to signal that this is the right connection. If we put that into more a schematic way, it looks like this. This is again the antigen-presenting cell. This is the antigen which is presented to the receptor and gives the signal 1. Then you need your co-stimulus, and this gives you the signal 2. This fortifies signal 1. Then it goes to the nucleus, and then the third signal is interleukin 2. It's a very important interleukin, which is required for the replication of this cell. Interleukin makes the cell proliferate because we only have about, say, a 10 or maybe 100 lymphocytes who are able to recognize the tetanus toxoid you have injected. So those 100 are not enough to give an appropriate immune response. You need more. So to safeguard autoimmune responses, the body has kept the number of reactive T cells and B cells to a very low level. And only when they are allowed to react, then they start to proliferate. And that is what we call clonal proliferation. So you get thousands of cells that can all recognize the same antigen. And now you have enough cells to give a strong immune response. Now, this is true for T cells, but it is also true for B cells. But there's something special about B cells. B cells carry the antibody they produce on the outside of their cell membrane. And they can bind much bigger antigens. So the T cell can only recognize small parts of a protein, 10 amino acids, but B cells can really recognize large molecules, and they can recognize proteins, they can recognize sugars, they can recognize lipids. So they have much more flavors. And they have two things. First of all, they can also act as an antigen-presenting cell. So they can recognize the antigen, take it up, break it down, and present it to a T cell, and then receive help to produce the antibody they need to produce. Now, again, when the number of B cells is too low, so they have to replicate firstly. And during that replication, small mistakes are made in the genes that code for the antigen binding site of the antibody. That means that the generation from this B cell contains cells that have binding sites that can bind the antigen less well, and you have binding sites can even more bind to the antigen. And that's very important because the replication rate of those B cells in the lymph node is extremely high. Every 6 to 8 hours, there is a duplication of number of cells. That means that if it is not controlled and all of those cells would live, after about 10 days, the number of cells would be 1 billion of cells. Now, you know your own body contains about 1,000 billion cells. So within 10 days, most of your cells would be B cells. So it is very tightly controlled. And the way it is controlled is that you need to bind to an antigen presented by this follicular dendritic cell in the lymph node to survive. So all B cells will replicate, During replication, small mistakes are made in the antigen binding site, and only those B cells with antibodies that can bind the antigen very strongly, they will survive, all the other will die. And then you can also start to understand when this process goes wrong, like in lymphoma, like a Burkitt lymphoma, for example, where you can actually feel the glands growing under your fingers. This is because this negative feedback is disturbed. Now, this center is called the germinal center, so where this replication takes place. And those B cells, when they finally survive, they will further differentiate into plasma cells, which will produce the antibody, and memory cells, which will recognize the antigen in the future. Now, if you inject inactivated vaccine, the germinal center will disappear after 3 to 4 weeks because there is no antigen left, and so the germinal center will disappear. And that's one of the reasons that you have to give an inactivated vaccine several times. One time is not enough to induce enough plasma cells to get a protective antibody level, or only very shortly, and you need also more memory to be boostable in the end. So therefore you need a second and even a third injection. So this is shown here. This is the first injection where you produce your first antibodies and you get your first peak of IgM going down and your IgG and going down again. Now if you give a second injection of antigen, for example a tetanus toxoid, this is a special situation. First of all, you have memory. So your memory cells will recognize now the antigen and will be much more easily because they are memory cells, and so they will replicate much more quickly and you get a very quick response with more antibody production. But there's something else. Again, the B cells will replicate, the antibodies will they make small mistakes on the antigen binding site, and now they have to compete with the antibodies which are already present in the blood. So in the lymph node, they have to make antibodies which are even better than before. Otherwise, they will die as well. So the secondary response after the second injection will make B cells which have better antibodies with higher affinity, as is shown in this slide. And even if you give a third one, you get a similar approach with higher levels and even higher affinity, because you have to compete with the already circulating antibodies which are present. So you can summarize these results as follows. So that every injection counts. If you inject a protein vaccine like tetanus toxoid, like Hep B or like Hep A or rabies vaccine, all these types of vaccine, every injection counts because the first injection induces memory. The second injection will actually activate the immune response. So you have what we call memory T and B cells will recognize the antigen and will start to replicate. They will replicate because the numbers are much higher, the more cells will replicate, and they will replicate much more easily, so you get a very quick antibody response. So it's a rapid response, and the antibodies that are formed have a high affinity. So if you take this student who goes to Varanasi for an elective, has received in 2006 two injections of Hep A B vaccine, so hepatitis A and B vaccine. And now the question is, she's traveling in 2011 again, and which is 5 years after that vaccination, what to do with the, does she need a new vaccine? Because we know the scheme is normally three injections. Do we need to give one? Do we need to give two because it's such a long time ago? Or do we have to start all over again and do we have to give three? So I would like to see some hands for those people who think just one dose would be enough. Two. No hands in two. And three. No hands in three. So one dose is enough. Indeed, you only need one dose. As I told you, this will induce your immunologic memory, and that memory is almost lifelong. Now, human life, actually, evolutionary, is just 30 years. So 30 years for sure, 80 years, that's doubtful, I would say. But 5 years, that's okay. So there is memory, just one injection is enough. This is true for all the proteinaceous vaccines. So diphtheria, tetanus toxoid, inactivated polio, rabies, Hep A, Hep B, GA, just name it. So that's the second student. It's a 19-year-old student from Hong Kong. She is going to Africa. And she has had this, so she is leaving very soon. I'm not sure whether it's registered in Hong Kong, but in Europe, you have what we call an accelerated scheme, where we can inject Hep B at day zero, week one, and week four, and then you have protection. Most young people will have protection when they leave. The question is actually how to proceed afterwards when she comes back. Does she need additional vaccines, and how much does she need? No vaccine, because she had three, one dose, or two dose? So again, I would like to see some hands. No vaccine. A few hands. Okay. One dose. Also a few hands. And two doses. No hands. Well, actually, I told you that the germinal center is there for 4 weeks. So if you give your second injection on week one, the whole process of actually proliferation, then the selection in the lymph nodes, and formation of memory is still in process. So you are actually giving extra antigen, but at the moment there are not so many cells to react. There's not memory to respond yet. And only at 4 weeks you will have some memory cells that can respond. So in general, the levels will go up quicker, but the height of the antibody level will be lower. And for that reason, it is why to get a long-lasting protection, you need an extra dose. So if you have a rapid... the conclusion is that if you postpone an injection, in the meanwhile, the antibody levels may go down and you may be unprotected, but your memory will still persist and you can give another boost, and then you'll get protection for a very long time. If you shorten the interval, you're actually interfering with the process, and you often have to give an additional vaccination afterwards to get long life memory. So this is for the inactivated vaccines. The difference with inactivated and live vaccines is that for live vaccines, you only have to give one dose. It's an all or nothing game, because what happens is that the virus you inject will replicate in the body and cause an infection without many complaints, and the immune response then will control the infection, and by doing that you won't get ill, and secondly you get lifelong protection. Now the reason why we repeat live vaccine, for example in childhood vaccination, is that a small percentage of people do not respond to the first vaccination. As I said, it's an all or nothing game. So for most people respond with an infection, but in some people maybe the innate immune response is so strong that the virus is killed before it could replicate. And therefore we give often a second dose, of course it induces memory, but it is especially for those people who did not respond the first time. Now, this is an example of what happens after yellow fever vaccination. This is in the time after vaccination. And then we can see that in people under the age of 40, about 50% of them have a viral load which is detectable on day 5, and it's up to about 100 copies per ml of blood. In comparison, yellow fever infection gives a billion copy numbers per ml of blood, so it is a really attenuated vaccine. And then you can measure antibodies, neutralizing antibodies, from day 10, which kill the virus, and then you can find no virus anymore, and all vaccinated people are protected. So with a live vaccine, you get replication of the attenuated vaccine strain, which is controlled by the immune response. So in case of an impaired immune response, the virus will be able to replicate longer and longer and longer and maybe cause disease. And after that, when it's controlled, you get lifelong protection. And again, lifelong, I think, is in the order of 30, maybe 40 years, but for yellow fever, at least 20 years. Now, just to show you that yellow fever is not completely harmless, it can induce neurological symptoms, encephalitis, 1 in 1,000,000 doses. In small children below the age of 9 months, actually below the age of 6 months, and in immunocompromised patients, it can but also in normal immunocompetent persons, it can occur, but it's very rare. And the same is with the yellow fever-like illness, which already was named yesterday. Also, 1 in 1,000,000 is generally the occurrence. In contrast to the encephalitis, it does have a mortality rate of about 60%, and it's more prevalent in the older and also in the immunosuppressed patient, but especially in the elderly. And then it's estimated to occur in about 1 in 50,000 doses instead of 1 in 1,000,000. So what's so different between this old man and the immune system of this young girl? Well, when you age, your thymus is actually becoming more and more fatty. So it loses the epithelium, which the cortex, which is producing the naive T cells. So during time, when you get older, and it's actually the same during life, you are working on your memory, and it's much more harder to learn new things. You lose T cells, which can recognize the antigen. And your immune system becomes a little bit like in Emmental or cheese, with holes. There are some things you cannot recognize anymore, because you don't have the T cells to do that. So if you inject yellow fever vaccine in the elderly, this gives a different picture. These are the gray bars. What you can see, again, this is 100 on day 5 in 50% of the normal. It will be about 10 to 100-fold higher in 80% of the elderly. So more older persons have viremia, which is also higher than compared to younger people. And it takes longer for them to produce neutralizing antibodies, 50% on day 10 and 100% on day 14. So you can imagine that in certain circumstances, older people may take too long to produce antibodies, so the virus will go up even further, and then at the moment the immune system comes in, you actually have so many cells that are infected that you get organ damage and that you can have visceral yellow fever-like disease. And for that reason, yellow fever vaccine is not it's not advised for areas where the risk of yellow fever is below 1 in 50,000, you be very conservative. So the areas where you would advise yellow fever vaccination would be west of Africa and the Amazon region. Now, we are getting to the most difficult part now, because this is the polysaccharide vaccines. There are a few polysaccharide vaccines. They are sugars. And sugars are long molecules, and they are able to bridge more antibodies on the B cell. And in that way, they can activate the B cell without T cell help. And therefore, the body is able to respond very rapidly to the presence of, for example, a pneumococcus in the bloodstream, because the polysaccharides in the bloodstream will activate the B cell immediately. You don't need a T cell. You don't need antigen-presenting cells, and you have antibodies very, very, very quickly. The problem is that there is no T-cell help, so there is no memory, and the antibodies do not fit very well. There is no affinity maturation. And there's another problem. Those B-cells are present in the spleen, and they are only there after the age of 2. So that explains why small infants and small children are so susceptible to Staphylococcus pneumoniae, to Haemophilus influenzae, and to Neisseria meningitidis, because they cannot make that rapid antibody response in the blood. So to circumvent that, you can make a conjugate vaccine. Now, please pay attention, because this is this acquires all your attention. As I told you, the antibody present on the B cell can recognize all types of antigens. So they can also recognize sugars. So if you bind the sugar now to tetanus toxoid, this is the conjugate vaccine, this B cell recognizes the sugar molecule. So it takes up the antigen, it breaks it down in small pieces, and it will present sugar parts of the sugar, but it will also present parts of the protein. In this situation, it will present parts of the tetanus toxoid. As a consequence, it is recognized by T cells which recognize the tetanus toxoid protein part, and it will activate the B cell to produce antibodies. But because the B cell in this situation did not recognize tetanus toxoid, but the sugar from for example, pneumococcus, it will make antibodies against pneumococcus. So that's the trick behind the conjugate vaccine. So actually, you're fooling the immune system. You are using the fact that B cells are antigen-presenting cells and that T cells do not react to the same type of antigen as the B cell can recognize. And in that sense, you can actually make antibodies against sugars even before the age of 2. And therefore, you can immunize your children with a conjugate vaccine. So like the pneumococcus conjugate vaccine, the Haemophilus influenzae conjugate vaccine, and the meningococcal conjugate vaccine. What you do is actually binding the sugar to a protein, and because the B cell is an antigen-presenting cell, it will present also the protein to T cells, and therefore the B cells which recognize the sugar will get the necessary help from the T cells to produce antibodies against the sugar. So this is the first part. When I told you about the role of adjuvants, how it directs the immune response, we have talked about inactivated vaccines, and we have talked about live-attenuated vaccines. The big difference is that attenuated vaccines, live-attenuated vaccines, they replicate in the body, so the amount of antigen becomes more and more. You just need one injection. But if you have no immune response, the antigen will become more and more and more and become ill. So you need an immune response to control that infection. And then in the end, you will have lifelong protection. For the inactivated vaccine, you have to repeat your vaccination a few times because the germinal center will disappear after a few weeks. The immune memory you've created can be boosted in the second and third injection, giving you, again, lifelong protection. Polysaccharide vaccines are different. They don't need T-cell help. They can activate B-cells on their own, but they give short-lived antibody responses of low quality, and they do not work in small children. Therefore, we need conjugate vaccines which actually recognize the protein but produce antibodies against the sugar. The memory you get is lifelong, and this means that you can boost it at any time as long as your immune response is working. And during the aging process, the capability of recognizing new antigens decreases, whereas the memory is well conserved. And with this knowledge, we go back after the break to look at the immunosuppressed host. Thank you very much.